Oh, here I am. Finally. It's really good that you've stayed the course, and here we are together again. Thank you, Tom, for inviting me back here. It feels a little bit like a second home, having worked with Sylvia over the years on the Schools for Tomorrow project. I was invited to talk about Colin Ward and educational concepts in the 1960s and 70s, and obviously with the connection with anarchism and education. And that allowed me to think about quite a number of things. There's lots of things I could have done. But Tom also said he'd like me to connect it with other things I've been doing in my own scholarship. And I suppose over the years, I've been quite interested in the body of the school child, contained, if you like, in the school building, and the relationship between ideas of being controlled and interned, if you like, and the idea of being let out and freed and actually walking out of the school. And also I've been inspired by somebody who died this week, Jonathan Miller. I don't know if he's known in this part of the world. Jonathan Miller was a fantastic individual who trained as a doctor in the 50s, but he moved away from medicine and embraced the arts and did a huge amount of work with the arts. So his life was about the bringing together of the sciences and the arts. And one of the things he said influenced me greatly. He talked about the neglect of the very familiar things that we don't notice because we're too familiar with them. The unremarkable and the neglected. And as I say, I've been interested in the body of the school child, the flesh and blood. And I'm a historian, I'm not an architect. I'm going to be talking about bodies today, flesh and blood. And I'm going to be talking about feet. Feet are at the extremities of our bodies, our hands and our feet. And I'm interested in, just like Jonathan Miller was interested in the neglected and overlooked, I'm interested in the things that are on the edges. So the feet are on the edges of the body. And I'm interested in the edges of the school. Borderlands, barriers, well, we've just talked about barricades. It's very interesting, that connection. So I've decided to talk about walking in relation to Colin Ward's work. So We Make the Road by Walking is the title of a book by Miles Horton and Paulo Freire, published in the 1990s, in conversation with each other. So I'm going to start with a letter I received, an email I received, just as I was putting this presentation together a few days ago. Dear Kathy, hope you are well. We're looking how we can develop our learning spaces for older children. Currently, my year six teacher has defaulted to the typical year six way, and we are conducting an action research project of sorts to consider different ways. Do you have any pertinent literature that could help us? So this is from a head teacher in a primary school, and the school has been designed to encourage cooperative, collaborative, group, active learning. It's a modern school, yet the current year six teacher wants to bring them back to sitting in rows. I asked him what she meant by this, and he said that she wants to have them sitting in rows because they're going to be moving up to the secondary school where they're going to be expected to sit in rows. It's all a bit depressing, really. Schools of tomorrow, we've got a long way to go. So one reading of this note is to regard it as a positive indicator that the head teacher of a primary school is inclined not to just accept the space of the school as given and is keen to open up to other possibilities. Another reading is to reflect on the possible meanings attached to the words different ways. In other words, the imagined possibilities of different ways to educate these 10 and 11-year-olds is most likely limited to arrangements of furniture, accepting without question that the pupils will be situated and likely seated for the most part of the day in the classroom. A third reading of this note is to consider what is meant by the words pertinent literature. The likelihood is that the teacher in question is seeking research-based evidence that certain furniture arrangements tend to promote certain measurable outcomes. Yeah? We're very familiar with, well, as educationalists, we're very familiar with this idea. On measuring success in education, one of my favourite words of wisdom come from Sir Alec Clegg, who was a most important progressive educational administrator in the middle of the 20th century, well known around the world, and he looked after education in the West Riding of Yorkshire between 1945 to 1974, an extremely progressive individual, who said, "The things that are most easy to measure in education are the least valuable, and the things that are most difficult to measure are the most valuable." Clegg admired Colin Ward and made copious notes on his own copy of this book, Streetwork, The Exploding School, which I have here. So this is Clegg's copy. And if any of you are interested in leafing through it afterwards, I'll leave it here. It's full of, can you see his by-road notes? Which is wonderful. It's like layered history, this. It's fantastic. So I'm going to focus on this book today in my talk, because you can see it's about walking. It's about walking out, and it's about peripatetic pedagogy, if you like, and incidental education. So how might a powerful text from 1973, Streetwork, The Exploding School, be received in a contemporary school, should I suggest it? The first thing I wanted to say was, take this book, Streetwork, The Exploding School. But, you know, it just wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't ring true. In this presentation, I want to use a discussion of this radical and provocative volume by Colin Ward and his friend Tony Fison to examine something of the nature of anarchist interventions into mainstream education in the past and to assess its continued relevance today. In particular, I want to show how street work utilises the idea of walking out, and a pedestrian pedagogy essentially involving the feet to challenge the hegemony of the classroom and open up radical possibilities for change. I'll argue that the vocabulary of dynamic change, the exploding school, the expanding classroom, was the title of a BBC TV series in the late 60s, explosion, expansion, that characterised anarchist penetration of the mainstream during the post-war decades in the UK and in parts of America was enabled by a deep-rooted progressive tradition of challenging the physical rigidity of the body of the school pupil imposed by traditional pedagogies and classroom design. So I'm interested in the feet, I'm interested in walking as challenging the general consensus of interest in the school pupil's body, that being everything above the midline. Interested in the hands, yes, in making things. Interested in the head, speeches, the sensory perception of the eyes and so on. And increasingly, the interest in the brain and measuring and examining and visualising what's going on in the brain. So, I'm going to look beyond that and look down at the feet and walking. Let us out was a plea made by pupils who were consulted in 1968 as to the school that they'd like in Britain, and the operation was done by the Observer newspaper, who ran a competition to generate ideas about how education could be experienced by secondary age school children. And this book, which I'd highly recommend if you can get hold of it, it was published in 1969, edited by Edward Blishen, who was a friend of Colin Ward's, and it's beautiful. It's full of very sensible ideas, and it's full of ideas from children saying they wanted to learn through action, through research, through being involved in the world, not contained behind four walls. More than a generation later, Jonathan, aged 17, made a similar plea in a competition hosted by the Guardian newspaper in 2001. And you can read that there. So the School I'd Like book, which was published in 2003, and as Tom mentioned, there's been a revisiting of that republication in 2015. It really began with the competition run by The Guardian in 2001, which revealed so many amazing ideas, and ideas about changing relationships between pupils, teachers, between schools and wider community, and reiterated many of the arguments made by children in the 1960s. If you ask children anywhere in the world, it's my contention, they will focus on exactly the same things. We don't need to ask them anymore. But this quote is lovely. Schools should become part of the local and international community and would take part in solving some of its problems. So I'm interested in breaking out of the school, the borders, the border between the school and the community, focused on by John Dewey in the very early part of the 20th century. And after the war, the ruins left by the bombing of cities were recognised by some to offer children the resources they needed for creative play. So looking at children's activities in the public spaces, outside of schools, outside of their houses, interested people greatly, and as we heard yesterday, influenced many of the ideas about playgrounds. So borderlands, peripheries, the in-between spaces of school and village, town or city in which it sits, have historically drawn the vital interest of radical minds. The edges are arguably where creative possibilities begin. This was evident already in radical experiments with the curriculum achieved during the war years in parts of England. A powerful and influential example being Stuart Street School in Birmingham, where the whole curriculum was taught through the arts, and where the corridors were used, where the in-between spaces in between the classrooms were used and children piled into those available spaces. And Alec Clegg talked about this school as being his epiphany, opening his eyes to the possibilities of education, the whole curriculum taught through the arts. So I've written about Stuart Street School in many different places. You could follow that up if you're interested. Returning to walls as markers of that divide between the life of the school and the life of community, the artist Peter Perry, who was an emigre artist coming from Nazi Europe in the 1950s. The artist Peter Perry manifested in his horizontal reliefs the slantwise significance of reaching beyond the school towards understanding and knowledge rooted in social learning. His sculptures are fantastic, and Sir Alec Clegg was chief education officer for Yorkshire commissioned some of these sculptures. Leicestershire was also a progressive authority and commissioned many sculptures by Peter Perry. Many of them are threatened, such as this Gladys at Greenhead High School in Huddersfield, which has been taken down and destroyed more recently because it was thought to be unsafe. There was a big campaign to save her, though. These things are very emotional. But I like the idea of bringing this image into the discussion of breaking down the walls or expanding or exploding the school, because it's a kind of slantwise reaching out towards horizontality. Colin Ward's publications, The Child in the City and Streetworks, The Exploding School, both appeared in the 1970s. And this time, 1970s, was really a time for celebrating education at the edges of the traditional school. The vision promoted in these works of a childhood characterized by freedom to roam, exploration, and ultimately collaboration in shaping their local environment had deep roots in post-war efforts to strengthen democracy through a focus on the body of the school child and education through the arts. Just mentioning the 1970s, you might have noticed that in Britain at the moment, there's a bit of a political goings-on. There's a bit of a crisis happening. I'm a bit obsessed with reading stuff about that. And I saw something the other day, an article in the Times newspaper about Labour's crazy idea about a radical education service from cradle to grave. It's an interesting idea. But the article said, back to the 1970s. Back to the 1970s. What did they have in mind about the 1970s? Obviously, it was thought of as a negative slide back to the 1970s. But for me, the 1970s are characterized by adventures, experiments, explorations, explosions. Not all positive, not all negative, but at least an extreme kind of energy. But I think when journalists say back to the 1970s, they don't have that in mind. They have in mind a kind of greyness, a drabness, a kind of, it's up to you. Think about it. I wonder what they mean. So there's another couple of sculptures by Peter Laszlo Perry. Ward liked to use the phrase, the man who knows his village understands the world. The man, well, in arguing that everything important starts in small ways, in small spaces, and that the only real politics are those of the parish pump, local politics. The act of walking out of the school for Ward and others of his generation who wished to promote the quiet but insistent revolution in primary education and expand it to embrace schooling for older children was an essential act in challenging and changing relationships between pupils and teachers and between school and community. Small steps, small acts, and planetary consequences reminds us of the very recent and continuing efforts of young children and young people, to shape their educational experience through worldwide school strikes. This would no doubt have enabled Ward to point to exactly the human-scale, fragmented, dispersed anarchy that he believed to be ever-present as a possibility in any and every present. While Ward and like-minded visionaries acknowledged the permanent presence of the institution called school, they called into question the presumed function of its design and the verticality of its projection. I've been thinking about verticality as opposed to horizontality in school design, in school buildings. There's a great interest just currently in building very high schools, vertical schools. In Australia, they've built a number of them, and there's an interest in the UK in that too. Although the trend seems to be easing off a little bit. But thinking about verticality and vertical schools has made me think about the opposite, horizontality, which I'll say something about in a minute or two. The walls of the school have become a playground of possibilities for many radical minds. The school without walls is one possibility imagined. Within an anarchist worldview, permeability of boundaries and borders appears to be necessary not only in the demarcation of physical spaces, but in the lines drawn between orders of subject knowledge. Walking becomes a dynamic mechanism of change, transforming the school and classroom into a centre for the celebration of human-scale knowledge generation rooted in interpretation and meaning-making. In other words, the school becomes a centre for making meaning out of what has happened outside of the school. Engagement outside of the school in community, and then coming back to the school building as a place to make sense of it. And precisely that idea was voiced by children in the School I'd Like competition in the UK in 2001. So in this sense, and reminded by the sculpture of Peter Perry, the school leans into the community, leans into the surrounding landscape, touching community, embracing city, at least slantwise, quite a nice word that, slantwise, and towards horizontality. Walking, I haven't got too many pictures of walking or teachers walking with children, although we know that walking out, hikes, school walks, school trails, have a deeply rooted in educational history from Pestalozzi and Froebel, who talked about walking. Walking is an essential human scale form of movement. It requires space and trajectory. The feet in perambulation produce a connection with the earth, especially bare feet with the ground. Walking has an interesting history in relation to ideas about education and the body in movement. And it was of considerable interest to progressives, be they designers, teachers, or artists, during the decades following World War II. The modern school, as it had developed, was fundamentally designed to prohibit walking, unless it be a form of drill. Moreover, educationalists were usually more concerned with stilling the feet as they focused on the upper half of the body. I've written an article in a journal called Pedagogica Historica precisely about all this, about the history of the feet in education, if anybody's interested in that connection. In the early part of the 20th century, then, the exercise of the lower limbs, particularly for boys, emphasized an authoritarian discipline. The social anthropologist Tim Ingold, who's one of the few people I know, academics, who've really focused on feet in their work, has argued that the mechanization of footwork, the control of footwork, in other words, was part and parcel of a wider suite of changes that accompanied the onset of modernity in modalities of travel and transport, in the education of posture and gesture, in the evaluation of the senses, and in the architecture of the built environment. Footwork was indeed characteristic of early 20th century schooling. Here's an image from around about 1900 of exercises and drill in the playground. And through marching, the body is propelled on a predetermined course by a mechanical movement that is unresponsive to any kind of interaction with the environment that opens up along the way. That's a quote again from Tim Ingold. Control of the lower limbs, then, of the school child continues to be characteristic of contemporary schooling, though often overlooked. It sometimes takes the form of lines drawn on the school corridors. I don't know if it happens in this part of the world, insisting that children walk on either side of the line when they're moving from class to class. I recently came across this, which is controlling the walk to school from the community by drawing lines and other features on the ground. So that's, you know, it's another example of control of the lower limbs. So this control occasionally extends to marking up pathways to and from the school, and this is an example I recently found in the UK. So, walking, openness, democracy. Yesterday morning, one of the questions was, what was behind the idea of openness? We know this, there was a huge interest in designing open education, open schools, and so on. This is from Evelyn Lowe School in London from 1966, which was celebrated as a school without classes in a very positive way in this article. You can see children moving freely through the corridors there. I think we need to think politically about the reasons behind openness. The American educationalist Carlton Washburn declared that for children to learn about democracy in the post-war world, where it was extremely important that they did, they should be given opportunities to exercise choice. And this included the choice of where as well as what to learn. So as a direct result of that kind of philosophy, that idea that children within schools should be free to move, free to choose, it was linked to ideas about strengthening democracy. And as a direct result, progressively minded designers of school interiors sought to provide a greater variety of spaces, including bays, alcoves, quiet rooms, and various nooks and crannies, as well as outdoor spaces encouraging socialization as well as play. Walking in school, as well as walking out of school, especially for young children, was envisaged at this time by some as an essential activity, and enjoyment in the act of moving from place to place was taken seriously by some designers and school architects who were interested in looking at best practice and designing to support best practice. And it was people like Alec Clegg who pointed them to where to find best practice. So in such schools as this, for large parts of the day, it was assumed by the 1960s that children of primary school age would be on their feet, making, measuring, counting, drawing, getting the materials they required, and exercising choice. Even 10 and 11-year-olds. At the same time, the teacher was imagined to be mostly on their feet, following the interests of children wherever they manifested. The progressive open school, in other words. The notion of learning through perambulation or incidental education was at the heart of a vision of education campaigned for by educators wedded to an anarchist interpretation of environmental education. So on this slide, we see street work, the exploding school, and alongside it, an extremely amazing and extensive publication, the Bulletin of Environmental Education, which was published monthly by education officers at the Town and Country Planning Association between around about 1970, 71, and into the early 80s. And Colin Ward was working with Tony Fison, their and produced this amazing publication, which went out to secondary school teachers on a regular basis. They subscribed to this publication, and it was full of ideas about how to work with children outside of the school walls. The notion of learning through perambulation or incidental education, as I said, was at the heart of the anarchist vision. In the USA, such a vision was promoted by Paul Goodman and put into practice in several experimental contexts in the 1970s and 80s, in the context of a critical questioning of all major institutions generated by the student movement of the late 1960s, which we've heard a lot about this weekend. In that context, those educationalists and architects, in sympathy with the anarchist groundswell for change, perceived that the political climate was conducive to a step-by-step educational revolution. To these folk, it seemed impossible to imagine a scenario whereby the school as container, the vertical school, could survive these efforts towards fundamental change. Streetworks, the book, imagined a scenario and suggested strategies towards the gradual and ultimate disappearance of any recognisable school as it had become established in localities and in the public's mind. School would be replaced by a system of urban pedagogy, linked centres for urban studies, staffed with folk who are well-trained to do this, whereby children learned mostly outside of the school walls to question their environment, identify problems, and assist in developing solutions, just as Jonathan, age 17, before, had suggested for the 21st century. This was considered to be working with the grain of human nature, assisted by children's natural curiosity and need for opportunities to develop awareness of self-worth. So I'll just show you one or two front covers of the Bulletin of Environmental Education. And the images which are used, I think, are very important. A whole study could be made on analysing what's going on in these purposefully designed images. This is from 1972, 15p. And quite a lot of the time, the images used in the B captured children making images themselves, using photography to record and analyse and document their world. So in this publication, Streetworks and the Bee, as it's known, Ward and others advanced the idea of the city as school. This was a radical approach that set out guidance on how learning might take place through engagement with pressing problems in environments that were familiar to young people and about which they cared. It came from a mindset that really trusted that children cared about the environment that they lived in, that, you know, that they weren't naturally destructive or ambivalent about it. It belonged to a climate of opinion held by progressive practitioners, architects, planners, and educationalists that believed it inevitable that by the year 2000, schools themselves will move closer to the world. The interpenetration of school and neighbourhood will be promoted by buildings in which design will become ever more open. The classroom box will disappear. The school building will come to be thought of as a social centre. Now, Ken Laybourne, who said those words in 1962, talking about the year 2000, wasn't an anarchist. He was an inspector of schools. He worked for the government. He was a school inspector. Yeah, okay, progressively minded, but caught up in that assumption that school, as it had become established, could not be contained within this climate of change and questioning of all institutions. I often use this quote, take out the words by the year 2000, and then disappoint everybody by putting them back in. Yeah, it's really... But it's the history of thinking about schools for the future. We're still thinking about schools for the future, but that email I received on a couple of mornings ago reminds us that it's not so easy. During the late 60s across the Atlantic, a similar projection was voiced and visualised by architects and educators who together also could not imagine that the classroom box and the traditional form of schooling as it had developed in industrial nations could survive the contemporary climate which subjected all modern institutions to radical questioning. This is the front cover of a publication, a special issue of the Harvard Educational Review, Architecture and Education, in 1969, winter edition 1969. And it's a fantastic publication which has been lost to history. Hermann Herzberger has an essay in it, Giancarlo De Carlo has an essay in it, Aldo van Eyck, a Shadrach Woods, an American architect. The idea was to bring together the most radical architects and educationists of the time to enable them to talk about how school might be in the not-too-distant future. The architect Shadrach Woods, for example, argued that the architect Shadrach Woods argued that the city itself is the school, college, university. We see the city as a total school, not the school as a micro community. The theatre of our times is in the streets. Education then is urbanism, and urbanism is everybody's business, as is education. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Oh. I've spoilt myself, haven't I? Here we are. So within this publication, Robert Coles, who is a psychologist, has a conversation with children. This is an American child talking. A good school, she says, would have a road going right through it or under it, and you could see cars and stores and people, and they'd be looking at you, and you wouldn't have to take a bus and go away into nowhere just because you're going to school. And just to mention, I'm working with a colleague, Adam Wood, at the moment, in putting together a new a kind of recognition of this Harvard Educational Review Architecture and Education publication 50 years on, where we had a project in Cambridge where we brought together architects and educators today to reflect on these essays. And one or two people in the room were involved in that, and we're putting together a publication, including, I think we're allowed to reproduce three of the original essays from this publication with a set of new essays. So watch this space for that publication. How am I doing for time? Am I out? Okay, so I'll just finish off by talking about, very briefly, about my idea of horizontality. Were school to explode into the community, as Ward and Fison envisaged, and as the art of Peter Perry suggested, Teaching and learning would happen primarily in the streets and neighbourhoods of our towns and cities. This would transform many things. The profession of teaching, for instance, and the nature of training and development would by necessity be very different. The responsibility of the urban pedagogue would be to seek out opportunities to engage the whole community in projects that could enable young people to work together to help bring about change. A kind of mastery of the environment. Cities might become less places of consumption and more places of invention and creation. What the notion of street work, the exploding school, and a horizontal perspective offers is a view of the natural inclination of children and young people to not only have a view and a voice when adults deem to consult them, but also to critique, reimagine, construct, and reconstruct their world. The architect Giancarlo Di Carlo argued, education is the result of experience, and the wider and more complex the experience, the deeper and more intense the education. How can we learn from the past and design for education to promote the increase in the variety of experience that might offer young people in urban environments multiple options as to who they are and might become beyond school success or failure? Street work offers a dynamic view of education that encourages the questioning of place, recognising it not so much as a work as a fixed abode, but rather as always subject to negotiation and change. The text is also a reminder that the anarchist characteristic of freedom to roam and determine one's own learning and living path was regarded as literally possible through peripatetic wandering, but always within a purposeful and structured framing of pedagogic intent. So my final plea is, can we stop building schools high or low and shift our vision as educators, architects and communities towards a horizontal view, a scenario where schools will no longer be simple destinations in the systems of circulation, holes in the fabric of the public domain, but will form an integral part of those systems and that domain. And that's where I'll thank you for listening and ask you to walk well.